Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be here. And to be honest with you, I was amazed how you can write poems in 20 minutes. Sometimes it takes me a year to get a three-line poem, a haiku, done. So maybe I rewrite them too often, and I tend to improve my poems. That's why I will read some of my poems from the list and not from the books. I'll start with poems from this collection. I write not only haiku, but mainstream poetry apart from fiction, which say for the poems. So I'll read a few poems from here. You see, some of the poems appeared in a couple of anthologies, Mr. Dedalus anthologies later, and I sort of changed them around, so I'll read the newest versions. The next poem is called Hunting in Flood Vicinities, and it's dedicated to the late writer from County Sligo, Gail Hazelton, who once reminded me of a Siberian saying, which not many people actually know it. It goes like this: when you kill wolves, people die. So it made me think, and I wrote a poem, the poem with this saying in the first two lines. When you kill wolves, people die. It is always the case, they bury the corpses together with the wolves. Years after, they exhumed them, and rebury them wrapped in flags. Each time, they take the flags from the living. The latter squat and cry a lot, naked, shielding with both hands, not what naked people usually shield, but spots of wild, greyish wolf skin on their breasts and withers. The next poem is about the idea of United Europe. I heard references to these poems, pro-European and anti-European. If you ask me, I don't know. I just wrote what I see. It's a vision of the map of Europe reflected in the mirror of teapots. You know, teapots, some of them, metallic ones, they can reflect things. And I saw that reflection. It made me actually write the following. It's called Europe in the Mirror of My Teapot. Europe in the mirror of my teapot is hard to recognize. This silvery curve enlarges France and Germany, but lessens other states. Ireland is barely visible. Russia tends to slide away to the dark side of existence. All the gaps between capes and islands are mended as if an invisible giant put in stitches. Croatia reaches for Italy. Sweden clings to Denmark. Former mortal enemies give each other hugs of love. Maybe it was like that in prehistoric times. This teapot seems to have its own vision of the world and the map of Europe on the wall. Practically speaking, teapots serve another purpose. Sipping my beauty's tea, I wonder if I can see the meaning in this image of unity and distortion, and also in their strange synchronicity. The next poem has some Russian images in it. when I, as I was writing it, I was thinking about all the Russian festivities, you know, military parades on, you know, in the Red Square and so on and so forth, and it grew out of proportion, and actually it gets distorted in the poem. So you can judge what you've got as a result. It's called Festivities Go On. On public holidays, the warmth of the crowd holds you captive. You merge into a vast mutual body. Only your raised hands are free, but have nowhere to go except down to the pebbles of heads. Cigarette smoke searches pockets and lungs. Your tongue is almost autonomous, but your words get lost among thousands of others. If you doze off now, you will see anything in your dream, even skeletons marching past through Red Square and rockets, watching them closely from the rostra. When you open your eyes again, the festivities will go on. You'll still have a chance to observe the huge inflated faces rising into the air. I've completely rewritten the next poem, so I'll read the new version that appeared in this book. But the new version is a bit different. It's called The Lakeside Wind. Just a small comment. Probably know that trees can be either... Okay, I'll try again. Trees can be either cryptogamous, if there are any biologists here, probably will correct me, probably mispronounce it, and phanerogamous, right? So for instance, an oak tree is cryptogamous, and an elm tree is phanerogamous. Don't ask me, I don't know. Anyway, the lakeside wind. In the grove of human trees, both cryptogamous and phanerogamous, each branch outlines a face. Beneath the reminiscences of rain-colored sky, volunteers are always there for the trees to water and fertilize them. They build their encampment in a glade. Small talks waft over from the kitchen on the smell of onion gravy. The television reports fires and the deforestation of Martian woods to the empty tents. Inhaling the lakeside wind, a gnarled old woodman walks past withered trees that failed the difficult test of others' concern for them, and he envies each leaf which has managed to break free with or without an inscription. Next is a poem, probably one of my first poems, started writing in English in 1992, 20 years ago. I think I was an awful writer back then. But I found this poem, I thought it was lost actually, it's a very short poem, it's called Tibet. It's a very Zen poem, nearly as Zen as my haiku. And I thought, altogether bad, so I don't know, I'll read it for you. Tibet, Himalayan terraces, gigantic steps, violet, lilac, blue, purple, crimson, last one being heaven. Next poem is not from this book. I think it was published in the anthology called London Places, published by Dedalus. Lessons of Irregular History. Second World War began in 1933, Hiroshima and Chernobyl in 1939, Quaker's Zenotic word is something's beginning today. Lack of knowledge is reassuring. In the garden of amnesia, raindrops land upon my radio as it tells me in a hoarse voice about people killed by fires and frontier incidents. However, it doesn't hint that something's beginning today. I tune in the radio. Now we hear the music of Mahler, St. Anthony of Padua, sermonizing to fishes. That music has no knowledge of today. It narrates what has been going on from the very sources of irregular history, while ill weeds form ears and exceptions to Darwin's theory appear in shady alleys. The next one appeared in Force 10 magazine. It's a Swagger magazine edited by German Theater. I've actually never seen the copy. So I wonder if it was published in this particular version. So when I see it, I'll know. It hasn't happened yet. It's called in the province of Potenza. Potenza is a province in Italy. Well, you know, the name gives certain associations. And of course, Duce is the title of Mussolini, you know, the Italian dictator, the fascist dictator. In the province of Potenza, we met a bold, agitated man who was introduced to us as Signor Pesca, the mayor of the village. He invited us to have lunch with him in the local trattoria, which is a pub in the diner. Il Duce, my learned friend, choked after having a close look at the man. Are you really alive? In a sense, yes, the man smirked. I suppose it's safe to talk to you. At least you are not Italiani. Mind you, I'm one of irregular grand. We, the great rulers, are always in our prime, and we get tempered with every passing year, especially after going through executions. You see, a rope makes the neck stronger. Bullets stiffen the body, and high tension current adds energy. Afterwards, one can rule over his nation under an assumed name, or even under his own. Subjects grow remorseful, erect monuments, establish museums, and seemingly are ready to welcome him with open arms. Those pygmies who don't know much about such obvious things as what will be going on after they're gone. Are you aware of who Signor Chavez really is? And the Belarusian Giovanotto. The worst part is that with every incarnation we lose a bit of importance. Destiny has brought me into such a strange region. I shouldn't be here at all. Rome is where I belong. His secretary found his way to our table. Mi scusi, signore, they're awaiting you at the meeting of the Environmental Commission. One more poem from Shadow of Time. The poem in straightaway, Cimmerian means ancient Crimean. You know that the first Crimean villages were built by the Greeks. So that's, I have to explain this. The poem is called Open Book. If the future sends us Cimmerian messages, this picture must be one of them. Underneath the dark, crumbling sky, a second-hand bookshop that sells not books, but their authors, speaking dolls. This one recounting 20 historical novels by Howard, and that one reciting 2 volumes of his poems. In the candlelit window, Cinderella dances with wooden Marie Carelli. 3 daughters of success narrate the story of their porcelain marriage to Mr. Nutcracker. I can see my pen and himself quietly getting onto a shelf. I expect to be selling well. One can read clearly on my face the promise of long hours running, fueled by incessant intellectual activity. Right, let's see how this goes. I wanted to structure my reading because I write not only these kind of poems, I also write prose poems, I write haiku. I'm going to read a few translations as well. So I think I'll switch to prose poems to kind of as a kind of distraction from what I read before. My prose poems, all of them, were originally written in Russian. I translated half of them. Another half has been translated by the good English poet Carol Runes. So I'll indicate who translated what. I'll start with Carol's translations.
The center of the universe. The red comb of that pheasant is the center of the universe. The pheasant moves, sometimes even flies, and the center of the universe shifts about with him. Why this particular pheasant, you ask? And why his comb? But the one who knows the answers has already shrugged his shoulders, the movement causing his gray comb to shake at the same time.
The next one is about James Bond.
James Bond retired and settled in the Soviet Union, for whose breakup he was responsible. His pension was delivered to him by pigeon post from Yorkshire. On Tuesdays, the former 007 attended party members' meetings and made recordings with a tape recorder embedded in a cigarette. The meeting ended with the singing of the Internazionale, but James Bond, on principle, murmured through his gray moustaches, "God save the Queen." Here's our comrade from the developing republic singing out of tune. "Tune," said the nimble old man in their pioneer ties, patting Bond lovingly on his cast-iron shoulders. More. Be careful with kites. When flying a kite in the long-suffering heavens, you never know what you may catch. If it's a dead bird or a piece of aircraft metal, no problem. But supposing a snag gets caught, God forbid the moon, a daring kite flyer will then find himself in direct and prolonged connection with the skies. And it isn't so far the case that should he finally decide to release his kite, it won't give him a chase.
Alright, following is my own translation. Quests and discoveries. It was the epoch of great underwater discoveries. All the ships were diverting their routes into the blue deep. After trawling the seabed, scientists on board the Titanic found deposits of copper and silver.
Everyone plunged into the depths, searching for gold. They had glimpsed in brilliant sunlit flashes. This was where I met a wonderful Eskimo girl, dressed in a fur coat and short doe-skin boots. She had just run out of oxygen, which proved to be an excellent reason for striking up an acquaintance. The next one is called British Lions. When lions started speaking English, animal keepers were the only ones who could understand them. Others didn't take the whole thing seriously. Wittgenstein famously said that if lions could talk, they would stop being lions. He didn't clarify, however, if animal keepers would remain human should they understand lions already. On Sundays, animal keepers and lions sit up straight at the round table in the local inn and, scarcely exchanging remarks, divide between them a huge Union Jack cake. At some stage, I started translating contemporary Russian poets. I ended up publishing an anthology called An Item, the Nabokov Hotel. It's published by Daedalus in 2006. I think it's still available. I don't have a copy here, I can't show you, but there are 20 contemporary Russian poets, mostly experimental poets. So I'll read a few of them. Sergei Strachanovsky, he's a librarian from St. Petersburg, one of the most respected poets of the generation of people in their 60s. He's in his 60s. It's called The Library Tower. It's a library tower and it pierces the sky. Hope and wine wind around winding stairs and story-sized volumes. All the locks on Sumerian chains are rusty. Black magic is blooming here, the secret wisdom of Adam. Someday, somebody will apprehend it and master it, and time will come to a halt, an angel will furrow the sky. The next poem is by the late great poet from St. Petersburg, Gennady Alexeyev. It's called Flowers. Flowers smell of funerals and love, but it's not their fault. Sometimes people shower flowers on rascals or present them to a stupid bit of scourge. Sometimes you see flowers stolen from graveyards and then sold to pairs of sweethearts at an exorbitant price. But it's not their fault. Flowers are not embarrassed by the fact that Giordano Bruno was burnt on the square of flowers. I don't know why I'm only reading poems by St. Petersburg poets, but I don't know, I'll read another. Well, in Russia, St. Petersburg is something of work, and that's what I'm talking about. The sense of locality, you know, that's what influenced me. The next one is called Fisherman. It's by a friend of mine, the poet whose name is Dmitry Grigoryev. Fisherman came back empty-handed. Fishermen say, the water is high, the water is troubled. Fishermen come back and spill and scatter like raindrops. Fishermen say, mud is floating down the river. It has been long since it started, and now fish is gone. But we shall return to the river as soon as our clothes get dry. A certain feeling of continuity. You know, if you start doing something, keep doing it. Start writing poems, stick to it. Right, maybe one poem by Moscow poet. A Future of Love by Konstantin Keter, the current president of the Russian Poetry Society, a good friend of mine. The sky is the width of a look. A look is the depth of the sky. Pain is the touch of God. God is the touch of pain. Breathing out is the depth of inhalation. Breathing in is the height of exhalation. Light is the voice of silence. Silence is the voice of light. Darkness is the stream of shining. Shining is the silence of the dark. Rainbow is euphoria of sunlight. Thought is voicelessness of the soul. Light is the profundity of knowledge. Knowledge is the pinnacle of light. Horse is the beast of space. Cat is the beast of time. Time is space curled up into a ball. Space is the horse of extension. And on this joyful note, I think I'll switch to reading poetry. Right. So I'll read a few from my. From my first haiku collection, it's called Morning at Mount Train, published by Dockhaus in 2007. Awakening, by the way, I'll start with Spring Haiku, just the book and my next collection, they're both structured according to the four seasons known in the Western world. So I'll start with Spring Haiku. Awakening to the echo of wind chimes, 10,000 birds and I. Hazel catkins in the mizzling rain, the long, long dream. Between snowfalls, the moon through cherry blossom petals. Summer haiku. In and out of a hilltop cabin, morning clouds. Summer night, blossoming in the pond, water lilies and stars. Trying to move along with as fast as I can. For reading from my last collection, I don't know. They call the poets like their last one best. But anyway, a few autumn haiku from this book. Leaflet about behavior on the streets. The wind feels it all over. Gloomy day, an actor practices a smile in the mirror. The doors creak softly, sleepwalking in my house, moonlight.
Some of them are one line haiku. The haiku workshop tonight, which I enjoyed very much. I got a few poems workshopped and accepted for the magazine I edit. And I tried to explain that apart from three-line haiku, they could be written in two-line. The main thing is that they should be should consist of two distinctive words. So I write sometimes, I write one-line haiku, like this one. Exploring a length of breath, autumn wind. Now, winter haiku. Murmuring surge, muscle shells slightly open. Climbing cloud peaks for the first time, New Year's moon. Right, and now I think, before I switch to the next collection. At some stage I did reworkings, haiku reworkings of newly found poems from the Dai Shoji Zen convent that's somewhere in Kyoto, the old capital of Japan. And there were some poems that the monks who actually were in charge of that convent, they didn't allow anybody to see it for God knows how many centuries. And an American scholar managed to get into it, copy the poems. And I did haiku reworking. There are some striking images. For instance, this one is a reworking of a poem by written as early as in the 11th century by somebody called Minamoto Masakane. It was like this. Autumn wind, I yearn for the place from where it blows. Now, if you think about it, for this one. It's actually was written in 1470 by an unknown poet. No, nobody knows who actually wrote it. And the haiku version of it goes like this. Snow-covered trees, some of them evergreen, which right, and I'll switch to this collection. Which will go from there. Old willow, a thousand branches holding the spring wind. Again, I started with spring poetry. Bursting buds on the bird cherry, each one a soundless bell. Moonlight through the mulberry tree, silkworms threads. Now, a few summer haiku. Sheep unmoved in the green grass, a slow passing of clouds. Burning sunshine, splashes of orange lightning on the dawn. Starry night, a black and yellow ladybird sits still. Telegraph wires, dawn singing a song to the nightingale. Heat lightning, a sunflower kissing the sun. Cloudy day, the green of water and the green of trees. faces exposed by the moonlight, colors blooming. Lapping of waves, the August sun in its cradle. Calm evening, the voices of birches and aspens. You see, haiku are mostly written about nature. Not a Japanese form called tanka, waka, mostly love poems, but if you write haiku, you have to write about nature. If you write about human relations, it's another form of, another old form of Japanese poem. It's called senryu. It's nothing wrong with writing them. Actually, all the major haiku publications, they accept senryu. But you just know, you should know for yourself, you know, what you're writing, all these books. Right, if you're not very tired, I'll read a few more. How am I doing on time, actually?
About,
taking
about 5 more
in poems. Oh, very good, very good. Yeah, now, autumn haiku. Aspen in the rain. Each leaf dripping with the sound of autumn. September heat wave, the moon and I. The next one was written in Dundee, where I actually live. Amid red and green flashes, the moon enters the tidal harbor. The next one is about Millennium Bridge and the new bridge in Dublin. Something like the title. Actually, I was crossing that bridge and there's fog all around me, so I wrote the following. Millennium Bridge, behind me and before me, cold fog. That's five.
Oh, a couple more.
Okay. That's good. So I have a chance to actually read this one. River stillness in the evening mist enters the log chamber. It's written in Germany near Frankfurt. We have huge log chambers there. I remember myself as a kid, as a child, I had a treasure, a pebble shaped like a heart. And so I remembered it at some stage and I wrote the following poem. Among the seabed pebbles, this one, shaped like a heart. And I think I'll finish that here. Thank you very much.